The porter walked Dunworthy across the quad, watching him warily, as if he thought he might turn suddenly dangerous. I might, Dunworthy thought. I want to use your telephone, he said when they reached the gate. University business! The porter looked nervous, but he set a telephone on the counter and watched while Dunworthy punched Balliol's number. When Finch answered, he said,
We've got to locate Basingham. It's an emergency. Phone the Scottish Fishing License Bureau and compile a list of hotels and inns. And get me Polly Wilson's number.
He wrote down the number, rang off, and started to punch it in, and then thought better of it and telephoned Mary.
I want to help source the virus, he said.
Gilchrist wouldn't open the net, she said.
No, he said. What can I do to help with the sourcing?
What you were doing before with the primaries. Trace the contacts, look for the things I told you about, exposure to radiation, proximity to birds or livestock, religions that forbid antivirals. You'll need the contacts charts.
I'll send Colin for them, he said.
I'll have someone get them ready. You'd better check Vadrie's contacts back 4 to 6 days as well in case the virus did originate with him. The time of incubation from a reservoir can be longer than a person-to-person incubation period.
I'll put William on it, he said.
He pushed the phone back at the porter, who immediately came around the counter and walked him out to the pavement. Dunworthy was surprised he didn't follow him all the way to Balliol. As soon as he got there, he phoned Polly Wilson.
Is there some way you can get into the net console without having access to the laboratory?
He asked her.
Can you go in directly through the university's computer?
I don't know, she said. The university's computer is moated. I might be able to rig a battering ram or worm in from Balliol's console. I'll have to see what the safeties are. Do you have a tech to read it if I can get it set up?
I'm getting one, he said.
He rang off. Colin came in, dripping wet, to get another roll of tape.
Did you know the sequencing came and the virus is a mutant?
Yes, Dunworthy said. I want you to go to infirmary and get the contacts chart from your great aunt.
Colin set down his load of placards. The one on top read, Do not have a relapse.
They're saying it's some sort of biological weapon, Colin said. They're saying it escaped from a laboratory.
Not Gilchrist, he thought bitterly. Do you know where William Gadsden is?
No, Colin made a face.
He's probably on the staircase kissing someone.
He was in the buttery, embracing one of the detainees. Dunworthy told him to find out Badri's whereabouts for Thursday through Sunday morning, and to obtain a copy of Basingham's credit records for December, and went back to his rooms to telephone Tex. One of them was running a net for 19th Century in Moscow, and two of them had gone skiing. The others weren't at home. Or perhaps, alerted by Andrews, they weren't answering. Colin brought the contacts charts. They were a disaster. No attempt had been made to correlate any of the information, except possible American connections, and there were too many contacts. Half of the primaries had been at the dance in Headington. Two-thirds of them had gone Christmas shopping. All but two of them had ridden the tube. It was like looking for a needle in a haystack. He spent half the night checking religious affiliations and running cross matches. 42 of them were Church of England, 9 Holy Reformed, 17 unaffiliated, 8 were students at Shrewsbury College, 11 had stood in line at Debenhams to see Father Christmas, 9 had worked on Montoya's dig, 30 had shopped at Blackwell's.
21 of them had crossed contacts with at least two secondaries, and Debenham's Father Christmas had had contact with 32, all but 11 at a pub after his shift. But none of them could be traced to all the primaries, except Vaudrey. Mary brought the overflow cases in the morning. She was wearing SPGs, but no mask. "Are the beds ready?" she said.
"Yes. We've got two wards with 10 beds each."
"Good.
I'll need all of them."
They helped the patients into the makeshift ward and into bed and left them in the care of William's nurse trainee. "The stretcher cases will be over as soon as we have an ambulance free," Mary said, walking back across the quad with Dunworthy. The rain had stopped completely, and the sky was lighter, as if it might clear.
"When will the analogue arrive?"
he asked. "It'll be 2 days at the least," she said. They reached the gate. She leaned against the stone passageway. "When all this is over, I'm going to go through the net," she said, "to some century where there aren't any epidemics, where there isn't any waiting or worrying or helpless standing by." She pushed her hand back over her grey hair. "Some century that isn't a 10. She smiled. "Only there isn't one, is there?" He shook his head. "Did I ever tell you about the Valley of the Kings?" she said.
"You said you saw it during the pandemic."
She nodded. "Cairo was quarantined, so we had to fly out of Addis Ababa. And on the way down, I bribed the taxi driver to take us to the Valley of the Kings, so I could see Tutankhamun's tomb," she said.
"It was a foolhardy thing to do. The pandemic had already reached Luxor, and we just missed being caught in the quarantine. We were shot at twice."
She shook her head. "We might have been killed.
My sister refused to get out of the car. But I went down the stairs and up to the door of the tomb, and I thought, this is what it was like when Carter found it."
She looked at Dunworthy and through him, remembering it.
"When they found the door to the tomb, it was locked, and they were supposed to wait for the proper authorities to open it. Carter drilled a hole in the door and held a candle up and looked through."
Her voice was hushed.
"Carnarvon said, 'Can you see anything?' And Carter said, 'Yes, wonderful thing.'"
She closed her eyes.
"I've never forgotten that. Standing there at that closed door, I can see it clearly even now."
She opened her eyes.
"Perhaps that's where I'll go when this is over. To the opening of King Tut's tomb."
She leaned out the gate.
"Oh dear. Started raining again. I must get back. I'll send the stretcher cases as soon as there's an ambulance."
She looked sharply at him.
"Why aren't you wearing your mask?" "It causes my spectacles to steam up. Why aren't you wearing yours?"
"We're running out of them."
"You've had your T-cell enhancement, haven't you?"
He shook his head.
"I haven't had any time." "Make time," she said, "and wear your mask. You'll be of no help to Kivrin if you fall ill."
"I'm of no help to Kivrin now," he thought, walking back across to his rooms.
"I can't get into the laboratory. I can't get a tech to come to Oxford. I can't find Basingham."
He tried to think who else he should contact. He checked every booking agent and fishing guide and boat rental in Scotland. There was no trace of the man.
Perhaps Montoya was right and he wasn't in Scotland at all, but off in the tropics somewhere with a woman. Montoya? He'd forgotten completely about her. He hadn't seen her since the Christmas Eve service. She'd been looking for Basingham then, so he could sign the authorization for her to go out to the dig. And then she had rung up on Christmas Day to ask whether Basingham was trout or salmon, and rung back with the message, never mind. Which might mean she had found out not only whether he was salmon or trout, but the man himself. He climbed the staircase to his rooms. If Montoya had located Basingham and got her authorization, she would have gone straight out to the dig. She would not have waited to tell anyone. He was not even certain she knew he was looking for Basingham, too. Basingham would surely have come back as soon as Montoya told him about the quarantine, unless he had been stopped by bad weather or impassable roads. Or Montoya might not have told him about the quarantine. Obsessed as she was with the dig, she might merely have told him she needed his signature. Miss Taylor, her four healthy bell ringers, and Finch were in his rooms, standing in a circle and bending their knees. Finch was holding a paper in one hand and counting under his breath. "I was just going over to the ward to assign nurses," he said sheepishly. "Here's William's report." He handed it to Dunworthy and scurried out. Miss Taylor and her foursome gathered up their handbell cases. "Miss Wilson called," Miss Taylor said. "She said to tell you a battering ram won't work, and you'll have to go in through Bray's Nose's console." "Thank you," Dunworthy said. She went out, her four bell ringers in a line behind her. He rang the dig. No answer. He rang Montoya's flat, her office at Bray's Nose, the dig again. There was no answer at any of them. He phoned her flat again and let it ring while he looked at William's report. Badree had spent all day Saturday and Sunday morning working at the dig. William must have been in contact with Montoya to find that out. He wondered suddenly about the dig itself. It was out in the country from Whitney on a National Trust farm. Perhaps it had ducks or chickens or pigs or all three. And Badree had spent an entire day and a half working there digging in the mud. A perfect chance to come in contact with the reservoir. Colin came in soaked to the skin. "They ran out of placards," he said, rummaging through his duffel. "London's sending some more tomorrow." He unearthed his gobstopper and popped it, lint and all, into his mouth. "Do you know who's standing on your staircase?" he asked. He flung himself onto the window seat and opened his Middle Ages book. "William and some girl. Kissing and talking, all lovey-dovey. I could scarcely get past." Dunworthy opened the door. William disengaged himself reluctantly from a small brunette in a Burberry and came in. "Do you know where Miss Montoya is?" Dunworthy asked. "No. The NHS said she's out at the dig, but she's not answering the phone. She's probably out in the churchyard or somewhere on the farm and can't hear it. I thought of using a screamer, but then I remembered this girl who's reading archaeohistory and, he nodded toward the small brunette. "She told me she saw the assignment sheets out at the dig, and Badree was signed up for Saturday and Sunday." "A screamer? What's that?" "You hook it to the line, and it magnifies the ring on the other end, if the person's out in the garden or in the shower or something." "Can you put one on this phone?" "They're a bit too complicated for me. I know a student who might be able to rig it, though. I've got her number in my rooms." He left, holding hands with the brunette. "You know,
If Miss Montoya is at the dig, I could get you through the perimeter, Colin said. He took his gobstopper out and examined it. It'll be easy. There are lots of places that aren't watched. The guards don't like to stand out in the rain. I have no intention of breaking quarantine, Dunworthy said.
We are trying to stop this epidemic, not spread it.
That's how the plague was spread during the Black Death, Colin said, taking the gobstopper out and examining it. It was a sickly yellow. They kept trying to run away from it, but they just took it along with them.
William stuck his head in the door.
She says it'd take 2 days to set it up, but she's got one on her phone if you want to use that.
Colin grabbed for his jacket.
Can I go?
No, Dunworthy said, and get out of those wet clothes. I don't want you catching the flu.
He went down the stairs with William.
She's an undergraduate at Shrewsbury, William said, heading off through the rain.
Colin caught up with them halfway across the quad.
I can't catch it. I had my enhancement, he said. They didn't have quarantines during the Black Death, so it went everywhere.
He pulled his muffler out of his jacket pocket.
Botley Road's a good place to sneak through the perimeter. There's a pub on the corner by the blockade, and the guard nips in now and again for something to keep warm.
Fasten your jacket, Dunworthy said.
The girl turned out to be Polly Wilson. She told Dunworthy she had been working on an optical traitor that could break into the console, but hadn't managed it yet. Dunworthy phoned the dig, but there was no answer.
Let it ring, Polly said. She may have a long trek to get to it. The screamer's got a range of 0.5 kilometer.
He let it ring for 10 minutes, put the receiver down, waited 5 minutes, tried again, and let it ring a 1/4 hour before admitting defeat. Polly was looking longingly at William, and Colin was shivering in his wet jacket. Dunworthy took him home and put him to bed.
Or I could sneak through the perimeter and tell her to phone you, Colin said, putting his gobstopper back in the duffel. If you're worried about being too old to go, I'm very good at getting through perimeters.
Dunworthy waited till William returned the next morning, and then went back to Shrewsbury and tried again, but to no avail.
I'll set it to ring at 1/2-hour intervals, Polly said, walking him to the gate.
You wouldn't know if William has any other girlfriends, would you?
No, Dunworthy said.
The sound of bells clanged out suddenly from the direction of Christchurch, pealing loudly through the rain.
Has someone switched that horrid carol on again?
Polly asked, leaning out to listen.
No, he said. It's the Americans.
He cocked his head in the direction of the sound, trying to determine whether Miss Taylor had settled for Stedman's. But he could hear 6 bells, the ancient bells of Osney, Deuce, and Gabriel, and Marie, one after the other, Clement, and Holt Clerk, and Taylor.
And Finch.
They sounded remarkably good. Not at all like the digital carillon. Not at all like O Christ Who Interfaces with the World. They rang out clearly and brightly, and Dunworthy could almost see the bell ringers in their circle in the belfry bending their knees and raising their arms, Finch referring to his list of numbers.
Every man must stick to his bell without interruption, Miss Taylor had said.
He had had nothing but interruptions, but he felt oddly cheered nonetheless. Miss Taylor had not been able to get her bell ringers to Norwich for Christmas Eve, but she had stuck to her bells, and they rang out deafeningly, deliriously overhead, like a celebration, a victory, like Christmas morning,
He would find Montoya and Basingham, or a tech who wasn't afraid of the quarantine. He would find Kivrin. The telephone was ringing when he got back to Balliol. He galloped up the stairs, hoping it was Polly. It was Montoya. "Dunworthy," she said. "Hi, Loopy Montoya. What's going on?"
"Where are you?" he demanded.
"At the dig," she said. But that was already apparent. She was standing in front of the ruined nave of the church in the half-excavated medieval churchyard. He could see why she had been so anxious to get back to her dig. There was as much as a foot of water in places. She had draped a motley assortment of tarps and plasteen sheets over the excavation, but rain was dripping in at a dozen places, and where the sagging coverings met, spilling down the edges in veritable waterfalls. Everything, the gravestones, the battery light she had clipped to the tarps, the shovels stacked against the wall, was covered in mud. Montoya was covered in mud, too. She was wearing her terrorist jacket and thigh-high fisherman's waders like Basingham, wherever he was, might be wearing, and they were wet and filthy. The hand she was holding the telephone with was caked with dried mud.
"I've been ringing you for days," Dunworthy said.
"I can't hear the phone over the pump." She gestured towards something outside the picture, presumably the pump, though he couldn't hear anything save for the thump of rain on the tarps. "It's just broken a belt, and I don't have another one. I heard the bells. Do they mean the quarantine's over?"
"Hardly," he said. "We're in the midst of a full-scale epidemic. 780 cases and 16 deaths. Haven't you seen the papers?"
"I haven't seen anything or anybody since I got here. I've spent the last 6 days trying to keep this damn dig above water. But I can't do it all by myself. And without a pump." She pushed her heavy black hair back from her face with a dirty hand. "What were they ringing the bells for, then, if the quarantine's not over?"
"Appeal of Chicago Surprise Minor."
She looked irritated. "If the quarantine's as bad as all that, why aren't they doing something useful?"
"They are," he thought. "They made you telephone."
"I could certainly put them to work out here." She pushed her hair back again. She looked nearly as tired as Mary. "I was really hoping the quarantine had been lifted so I could get some people out here to help. How long do you think it'll be?"
"Too long," he thought, watching the rain cascade in between the tarps. "You'll never get the help you need in time."
"I need some information about Basingham and Badri Chadhori," he said. "We're attempting to source the virus, and we need to know who Badri had contact with. Badri worked at the dig on the 18th and the morning of the 19th. Who else was there when he was?"
"I was."
"Who else?" "No one. I've had a terrible time getting help all December. Every one of my archaeohistory students took off the day vax started. I've had to scrounge volunteers wherever I could."
"You're certain you were the only two there?"
"Yes. I remember because we opened the knight's tomb on Saturday, and we had so much trouble lifting the lid. Gillian Ledbetter was signed up to work Saturday, but she called at the last minute and said she had a date."
"With William," Dunworthy thought.
"Was anyone there with Badri Sunday?"
"He was only here in the morning, and there was no one here then. He had to leave to go to London. Look, I've got to go. If I'm not going to get any help soon, I've got to get back to work."
She started to take the receiver away from her ear.
"Wait," Dunworthy shouted. "Don't hang up."
She put the receiver back to her ear, looking impatient.
I need to ask you some more questions. It's very important. The sooner we source this virus, the sooner the quarantine will be lifted and you can get assistance at the dig.
She looked unconvinced, but she punched up a code, laid the receiver in its cradle and said,
You don't mind if I work while we talk?
No,
Dunworthy said, relieved.
Please do.
She moved abruptly out of picture, returned and punched up something else.
Sorry, it won't reach,
she said, and the screen went fuzzy while she presumably moved the phone to her new worksite. When the picture reappeared, Montoya was crouched in a mud hole by a stone tomb. Dunworthy supposed it was the one whose lid she and Badri had nearly dropped. The lid, which bore the effigy of a knight in full armor, his arms crossed over his mailed chest so that his hands in their heavy cuirasses lay on his shoulders and his sword at his feet, stood propped at a precarious angle against the side, obscuring the elaborate carved letters. Requiesce was all he could see. Requiescat in pace. Rest in peace. A blessing the knight had obviously not been granted. His sleeping face under the carved helmet looked disapproving. Montoya had draped a thin sheet of plastine over the open top. It was beaded with water. Dunworthy wondered if the other side of the tomb bore a morbid carving of the horror that lay within, like the ones in Collins' illustration, and if it were as ghastly as the reality. Water spilled steadily into the head of the tomb, dragging the plastic down. Montoya straightened, bringing up with her a flat box filled with mud.
Well,
she said, laying it across the corner of the tomb.
You said you had some more questions?
Yes,
he said.
You said there wasn't anyone else at the dig when Badri was there.
There wasn't,
she said, wiping sweat off her forehead.
Phew, it's muggy in here.
She took off her terrorist jacket and draped it over the tomb lid.
What about locals? People not connected with the dig?
If there'd been anyone here, I'd have recruited them.
She began sorting through the mud in the box, unearthing several brown stones.
The lid weighed a ton, and we'd no sooner gotten it off than it started raining. I would have recruited anybody who happened by, but the dig's too far out for anyone to happen by.
What about the National Trust staff?
She held the stones under the water to clean them.
They're only here during the summer.
He had hoped someone at the dig would turn out to be the source, that Badri had come in contact with a local, a National Trust staffer, or a wandering duck hunter. But mixoviruses didn't have carriers. The mysterious local would have had to have the disease himself. And Mary had been in touch with every hospital and doctor's surgery in England. There hadn't been any cases outside the perimeter. Montoya held the stones up, one by one, to the battery light, clipped to one of the supporting posts, turning them in the light, looking at their still muddy edges.
What about birds?
Birds?
She said, and he realized it must sound as though he was suggesting she recruit passing sparrows to help raise the lid of the tomb.
The virus may have been spread by birds.
Ducks, geese, chickens,
he said, even though he wasn't certain chickens were reservoirs.
Are there any at the dig?
Chickens,
she said, holding one of the stones half raised to the light.
Viruses are sometimes caused by the intersection of animal and human viruses, he explained. Fowl are the most common reservoirs, but fish are sometimes responsible, or pigs. Are there any pigs there at the dig?
She was still looking at him as though she thought he was daft.
The dig's on a National Trust farm, isn't it?
Yes. But the actual farm's 3 kilometers away. We're in the middle of a barley field. There aren't any pigs around, or birds, or fish.
She went back to examining the stones. No birds, no pigs, no locals. The source of the virus wasn't here at the dig either. Possibly it wasn't anywhere. And Badri's influenza had mutated spontaneously, as Mary had said, happened occasionally, appearing out of thin air and descending on Oxford, the way the plague had descended on the unwitting residents of this churchyard. Montoya was holding the stones up to the light again, chipping with her fingernails at an occasional clot of mud, and then rubbing at the surface, and he realized suddenly that what she was examining were bones. Vertebrae, perhaps, or the knight's toes. Requiescat in pace. She found the one she had apparently been looking for. An uneven bone, the size of a walnut with a curved side. She dumped the rest back into the tray, rummaged in the pocket of her shirt for a short-handled toothbrush, and began scrubbing at the concave edges, frowning. Gilchrist would never accept spontaneous mutation as a source. He was too in love with the theory that some 14th-century virus had come through the net, and too in love with his authority as acting head of the history faculty to give in, even if Dunworthy had found ducks swimming in the churchyard puddles. "I need to get in touch with Mr. Basingham," he said. "Where is he?"
"Basingham," she said, still frowning at the bone. "I don't have any idea."
"But I thought you'd found him. When you phoned Christmas Day, you said you had to find him to authorize your NHS dispensation."
"I know. I spent 2 full days calling every trout and salmon guide in Scotland before I decided I couldn't wait any longer. If you ask me, he's nowhere near Scotland."
She pulled a pocket knife out of her jeans and began scraping at the rough edge of the bone.
"Speaking of the NHS, would you do something for me? I keep calling their number, but it's always busy. Would you run over there and tell them I've got to have some more help? Tell them the dig's of irreplaceable historical value, and it's going to be irretrievably lost if they don't send me at least 5 people and a pump."
The knife snagged. She frowned and chipped some more. "How did you get Basingham's authorization if you didn't know where he was? I thought you said the form required his signature."
"It did," she said.
An edge of bone flew suddenly off and landed on the plastine shroud. She examined the bone and dropped it back in the box, no longer frowning.
"I forged it."
She crouched by the tomb again, digging for more bones. She looked as absorbed as Colin examining his gobstopper. He wondered if she even remembered that Kivrin was in the past, or if she had forgotten her, as she seemed to have forgotten the epidemic. He rang off, wondering if Montoya would even notice, and walked back to infirmary to tell Mary what he had found out, and to begin questioning the secondaries again, looking for the source. It was raining very hard, filling off the downspouts and washing away things of irreplaceable historical value. The bell ringers and Finch were still at it, ringing the changes one after another in their determined order, bending their knees and looking like Montoya, sticking to their bells. The sound pealed out loudly, leadenly, through the rain, like an alarum, like a cry for help. Transcript from the Doomsday Book. Christmas Eve, 1320, Old Style. "I don't have as much time as I thought. When I came in from the kitchen just now, Rosamond told me Lady Hermione wanted me. Hermione was deep in earnest conversation with the bishop's envoy, and I supposed from her expression that she was cataloguing Father Roche's sins. But as Rosamond and I came up, she pointed to me and said, "This is the woman I spake of." Woman, not maid. And her tone was critical, almost accusing. I wondered if she'd told the bishop her theory that I was a French spy. "She says she remembers naught," Lady Hermione said. "Yet she can speak and read." She turned to Rosamond. "Where is your brooch?" "It's on my cloak," Rosamond said. "I laid it in the loft."
"Go and fetch it."
Rosamond went, reluctantly. As soon as she was gone, Hermione said,
"Sir Blowett brought a love knot brooch to my granddaughter with words on it in the Roman tongue."
She looked at me triumphantly.
"She told their meaning. And at the church this night, she spoke the words of the Mass ere the priest had said them."
"Who taught you your letters?"
the bishop's envoy asked, his voice blurred from the wine. I thought of saying Sir Blowett had told me what the words meant, but I was afraid he'd already denied it. "I know not," I said. "I have no memory of my life since I was waylaid in the woods, for I was struck upon the head."
"When first she woke, she spoke in a tongue none could understand," Hermione said, "as if that were further proof."
But I had no idea what she was trying to convict me of, or how the bishop's envoy was involved.
"Holy Father, go you to Oxenford when you leave us?" she asked him.
"Aye," he said, sounding wary. "We can stay but a few days here."
"I would have you take her with you to the good sisters at Godstow."
"We go not to Godstow," he said, which was clearly an excuse. The nunnery wasn't even 5 miles from Oxford. "But I will inquire of the bishop for news of the woman on my return, and send word to you."
"I wot she is a nun, for that she speaks in Latin and knows the passages of the Mass," Hermione said. "I would have you take her to their convent, that they may ask among the nunneries who she may be."
The bishop's envoy looked even more nervous, but he agreed. "So I have till whenever they leave." "A few days," the bishop's envoy said, "and with luck that means they won't leave till after the slaughter of the innocents. But I plan to put Agnes to bed and talk to Garwin as soon as possible."
This ends side 2 of cassette 11 of Doomsday Book. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 12.